Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Tim Blake Nelson is an actor. He was born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he's Jewish. Growing up, he says there weren't many other families like his in town. And you might think that, you know, kids being kids, maybe that made him feel bullied sometimes, singled out, or kind of weird. But that's not so, says Tim.
Kids wanted to come to your bar mitzvah. They were astounded to sit there and listen to the Hebrew. Couldn't believe that they were hearing that. It was exciting. Fascinating. There's that line. There's a line in Cormac McCarthy's novel, Outer Dark. And somebody asks another character, do you know what a Jew is? And the character responds, well, they're them old-timey people in the Bible. And that's what I felt growing up, that people embraced us, treated us as special friends.
It's Bullseye. Coming up, Tim Blake Nelson, star of the new Coen Brothers film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He majored in classics. He studied a lot. He actually didn't do a lot of acting until he got what you would probably call a very strong push from his mom.
And she said, look, why don't you spend the summer acting at one of these summer theaters? I said, oh, Mom, it's not that easy. And she basically said, don't give me your excuses. You have no family. You don't have any financial concerns right now. You don't even have a girlfriend. You're totally unaffiliated. Go get a job at a summer theater.
Then Mary Randolph Carter. She's an author and an expert on what she calls junk, collecting old stuff from antique stores and flea markets. She's got a whole design philosophy behind it, too.
And I think that when you do find and borrow things that have had that are old and weathered and tattered in some cases and patched, that's evidence of a life lived.
Then finally, I will tell you about the distinctly not fancy power of the TV sitcom Police Squad. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Tim Blake Nelson is an actor. Character actor, basically. He's from Tulsa, and you can hear a little bit of his accent. He plays that accent up in some of his roles. Maybe he'll play a desert-dwelling outsider, a corporate type from Texas who wears boots, maybe a Faulkner character. It's also made him an unforgettable part of some great movies, like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Coen Brothers classic.
Well, that's it, boys. I've been redeemed. The preacher done washed away all my sins and transgressions. It's a straight and narrow from here on out. And heaven everlasting's my reward.
Delmer, what are you talking about? We got bigger fish to fry.
The preacher said all my sins is washed away, including that Piggly Wiggly I knocked over in Yazoo.
I thought you said you was innocent of those charges.
Well, I was lying.
Now he's starring in another Coen Brothers movie. It's called The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. It just came out on Netflix. It's a Western made up of six vignettes. Each story is about the Old West, told in archetypes. A bounty hunter, a wagoneer, the big goofy gold miner with a big goofy beard and a burro. The kind of stuff that makes up the Coens' bread and butter. But like most great Coen films, it's more about how those archetypes get used. In Buster Scruggs, they're tweaked, caricatured, sometimes subverted, and it's all done in the service of bigger themes. Stuff like love, capitalism, justice, and death. My guest Tim Blake Nelson plays the title character in the movie, Buster Scruggs. Star and subject of the first vignette, he's a handsome kind of flamboyantly dressed singing cowboy with a revolver in his holster and a guitar around his back. A little bit like Gene Autry. He has a way with words. Like in this scene from the very beginning of the movie, Buster, who's played by Tim, is on horseback. He's ambling along a canyon in the kind of desert that you might see in a Wile E. Coyote cartoon. And as we're about to hear, he turns to the camera to introduce himself. And by the way, one visual thing, about halfway through this, he pulls out a wanted poster with his picture on it that labels him the misanthrope. Let's listen.
song never fails to ease my mind out here in the West, where the distances are great and the scenery monotonous. Additionally, my pleasing baritone seems to inspirit old Dan here and keep him in good heart during the day's measure of hoof clops. Ain't that right, Dan? Maybe some of y'all have heard of me. Buster Scruggs, known to some as the San Saba Songbird. I got other handles, nicknames, appellations, and cognomens, but this one here I don't consider to be even halfway earned. Misanthrope, I don't hate my fellow man, even when he's tiresome and surly and tries to cheat at poker. I figure that's just the human material, and him it finds in it cause for anger and dismay is just a fool for expecting better. Ain't that right, Dan?
Tim Blake Nelson, welcome to Bullseye. I'm so happy to have you on the show.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I have to say that I laughed almost embarrassingly loud in a hushed, sincere, serious critic screening of this film when you banged on the guitar strings as you swung the guitar over to your back.
Well, that's Joel and Ethan. There's a technique which they developed with their sound designer, Skip Livsky, called the hubcap.
Mm-hmm.
And in a Coen film, whenever something is disturbed and usually ends up being dispatched to a resting place off screen, you'll get a little bit of an extra sound from it, like a hubcap that's rolling off a...
You're doing the gesture of a settling hubcap.
Yes. And so, and they call it the hubcap. Joel and Ethan use sound, I think, better than any other filmmakers around, at least of which I know, other than maybe Steven Spielberg. It's such a presence in their movies. And of course, what you're describing there is definitely Foley'd. So they put that in and sweetened it. And that's just Joel and Ethan to a T.
When you're watching a film, often the sound is entirely transparent to you. Like you don't, the sound is often designed to be unnoticeable. And because all of the aesthetics in a Coen Brothers movie are 15% more saturated, like everything is heightened in this odd way. Just that moment of the guitar making a noise, it makes you notice the artifice of film, because guitars do make a noise when you do that. But they don't make a noise when you do that in a movie.
That's precisely right. And Joel and Ethan are always, as you imply, making movies about movies. That's always a part of what's going on, and it's part of what delights one when you see a Coen Brothers movie. You know that's happening, and you just want more and more of it. It's why I like to say that their films are, above everything else, generous.
There's this idea of the Old West as this lawless world, but so much of the Western genre is about the order being imposed on it by a good guy, you know, somebody riding a sheriff or whatever it is, right? And in this film, it's a story about the lawlessness and grotesquerie of the Old West as an idea, right? Like that there's no rules and anything can happen and people die and stuff. But it leaves out the part about someone coming in to make the rules. Like it's really just about, yes, living in a lawless world is brutal and terrifying. And also the actual world that we live in, all of our ideas of like what the rules are more tenuous than we give them credit for.
I think that's certainly true. And Joel and Ethan, if they're anything, are leaving their personal beliefs aside, they are decidedly Old Testament in that the universe, whether it's God conducting it or some other force, is an unpredictable, wrathful, and violent place. And the more man tries to control it and make sense of it, the more tragic his demise. In the case of Buster Scruggs, he's got a code, which is he'll never start a fight, but he'll always end one lethally. And they've written a character who would be a great friend, but a terrible enemy for you to have. But even he can't control his own destiny because he, when he least expects it, has his own reckoning.
Could you already do the things that singing cowboys can do? I mean, you're riding, playing, singing, shooting. I think those are the top four skills involved in being a singing cowboy, right?
It was so I didn't know how to play the guitar. I had to learn to do that. And I certainly didn't know how to twirl pistols. I ride well enough, but riding without being able to hold the reins and steer the horse with my hands and therefore needing to do it with my knees, that necessitated literally, and I'm not exaggerating, 5.5 months of prep. Because it has to look like he's done it all his life. And I didn't want to be on set worrying about whether my G chord was right. So I had to learn it to the extent to where I could just literally walk around the house playing the guitar while carrying on a conversation with someone, where I could twirl the pistols while talking with my wife and spin the gun right into my holster without having to look at it, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the Peter Pan life of an actor. It's constant regeneration. So getting to play a part like this at age 53, that's been my dream. It was a great challenge.
You're listening to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Tim Blake Nelson, star of the new Coen Brothers movie, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs. I want to play a scene of you, my guest, Tim Blake Nelson, in O Brother, Where Art Thou? It's about three inmates who escape from jail in search of buried treasure. If you haven't seen it, come on, get your act together. About halfway through the movie, Pete, who's played by John Turturro, goes missing. And Del Mar, played by my guest, Tim Blake Nelson, decides that Turturro's character got turned into a toad. And so when Del Mar walks into a movie theater and finds Pete back in handcuffs on a chain gang, he is quite surprised.
Do not seek the treasure. It's a bushwhack. They're fixing an ambush. Do not seek the treasure. We thought you was a toad. Do not seek the treasure.
Right there. What's the picture?
I mean, in a lot of ways, the character is entirely different from your character in Buster Scruggs, but it's the whole thing is so mannered that if there's any winking, the whole house of cards would collapse. And so you just have to have this beautiful, absolute commitment to the reality of that manneredness.
Yeah, that's what the Coen brothers ask for. And I think that's why you see them casting time and time again actors who've been trained formally in heightened language. So Fran, John Turturro, Michael Stuhlbarg in A Serious Man, so many of us, almost everyone in their
stable.
Went to school, went to a drama school and studied Shakespeare and Shaw and Restoration comedy, all of us. And what that trains you to do is to pick up a script, internalize the terms of its reality, and play them without any sense of irony or seeming over-intentionality or histrionics. You simply accept that that's the truth. It's a heightened world, and you become a part of it and engage with it on its terms. You lift yourself up to its terms. And I don't think that I would be able to do what I've tried to do for the Coens and the parts that I've had without having had that training.
Now, here's the thing that I'm confused about, Tim Blake Nelson. You went to literally two of the best schools in the world for college and graduate school. You studied possibly actually the two least practical things you can study. You went and got a degree in classics at a top-tier Ivy League university, and then you went off to arts college at Juilliard. So did you just have older siblings who had already broken down your parents, or were they like, well, if you're going to go into the arts or into scholarship, you got to do it 10 out of 10, and if you're doing it 10 out of 10, it's okay?
I think it was probably a bit more of the latter. We weren't the Soros family or something, but I definitely had resources to fall back on. And my education was paid for by my parents, so I graduated without debt. And that was an incredible help. I'm not going to lie about that or try to mislead. So I didn't have certain pressures on me that others do. I think my father probably wondered a bit about what was going to come of all this, and I don't blame him for that. My mother did a very astonishing thing, however, which was during my freshman year in college, she came up to visit me, and we were at dinner, and she said, well, what are you going to do this summer? It was the spring. And I said, well, I think I'm going to come home and stay with you. And my parents were divorced at this point, and the divorce was fairly recent. And so she was alone and I think lonely, and so had every reason to think, well, great, he's going to come home. I'll have one of my children home for the summer in the house. But that's not what she didn't respond to that temptation. She said, well, what do you want to do with your life? And I said, I think I want to become a classicist. I'd like to teach Latin in high school or maybe even get a master's and a PhD and pursue a life in the academy as a professor. And she said, look, nothing would make me happier than to have a scholar as a son. So that's fine. Great. But now is the time to take chances. And you used to like acting in high school. Why don't you, instead of coming home, you're still going to major in classics. You've made that clear. That's there for you in your future. Why don't you spend the summer acting at one of these summer theaters? I said, oh, Mom, it's not that easy. And she basically said, don't give me your excuses. You have no family. You don't have any financial concerns right now. You don't even have a girlfriend with whom you may want to be. You're totally unaffiliated. Go get a job at a summer theater. And she even helped me do that through a connection. And so I did. I went and acted in a summer theater, and we did Hay Fever and Real Inspector Hound and Lanford Wilson's play The Fifth of July. And I realized in that one summer that my mother had encouraged me to have, go be an actor, she had essentially said, try that out, that it is what I wanted to do. And I returned for my sophomore year in college and stuck with my classics major because I just loved it, but determined this is what I was going to do. And I pursued it vigorously. With her complete encouragement. And I think that's a pretty unlikely story, but it's true.
More from Tim Blake Nelson after a break. When we come back, he'll tell me about the time he got to play a villain in a live-action version of Scooby-Doo and how he would have gotten away with it, too, if it weren't for those meddling kids. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org, and NPR. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Squarespace. If you're ready to start your new business, get your unique domain name and create a beautiful website with help from Squarespace's 24/7 award-winning customer support. Head to squarespace.com/bullseye for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use the offer code Bullseye to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace.
I'm Bob Boylan with the All Songs Considered podcast. 50 years ago, the Beatles made a mind-boggling double album. Hear the White Album as you've never heard it before. From demo tapes to brand new mixes. This week on All Songs Considered.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Tim Blake Nelson. He's an actor, one of the stars of the new Coen Brothers film, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs, which is out now on Netflix. He's also been seen in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, Syriana, Hulk, and more. Besides that, he's a playwright. His latest, Socrates, plays at the Public Theater in New York this spring. Your family's Jewish. To what extent were there other Jews around in Tulsa when you were a kid?
The Tulsa Jewish community is a very cohesive one. Everybody knew each other and looked out for each other. It was amazing to grow up with European grandparents and a mother who'd been born in London but spent her first 5 years in Germany and in London. And to celebrate Passover and the high holidays in the middle of Tulsa, Oklahoma, I felt like I had everything because I'm growing up in the heartland and was aware enough to realize that there was strangely something quite special about that. As the world at that point was, the country at that point was already becoming more and more homogenous through television and advertisements and various periodicals making us, you know, making tastes more and more common and regionalisms more and more, less and less distinct. And I already had an understanding, as I think most of us did in Tulsa in the 70s, that we were in a special place that was in its way protected because nobody was coming to Tulsa for any attractions. Oral Roberts University, and you know, there wasn't, it wasn't a tourist destination. It was its own enclave. And yet I also had this foundation that was distinctively European with grandparents who'd brought over somehow, I really don't know how they did it, all their flatware from Europe. And we would have these Passover dinners or breakfasts on these European plates with Roemer glasses of hand-cut crystal. And I just felt incredibly blessed. And I loved all the funny accents at the synagogue from the European refugees, where you could hear people who were like off of a You Don't Have to Be Jewish album in the synagogue and then go out and hear people saying, hey, what's going on outside? That just wasn't lost on us, my family and me.
There's this David Cross album, David Cross, who is Jewish and grew up in Georgia, where, and I don't remember which album it is, and this is, I'm quoting from memory, but he describes the scene where he's over at a friend's house when he's, you know, 12 years old or whatever, and he has a sleepover. And the next morning, I'm making up the specifics. I can't remember exactly what it was, so my apologies to the great David Cross. But the mom asks him, do y'all's people eat pancakes? And I thought, like, that is like such a particular thing of being Jewish in a place where there's not that many Jews, is it's not about hostility, but just a kind of a vague awareness that things are done differently, but complete ignorance about in what specific different way they're done.
Yeah, but also a benign fascination. I mean, I actually felt appreciated. Kids wanted to come to your bar mitzvah. They were astounded to sit there and listen to the Hebrew. Couldn't believe that they were hearing that. It was exciting, fascinating. There's that line. There's a line in Cormac McCarthy's novel, Outer Dark. And somebody asks another character, do you know what a Jew is? And the character responds, well, they're them old-timey people in the Bible. And that's what I felt growing up, that people embraced us, treated us as special friends. It was only when I went to the Northeast to college, and then particularly in New York, that I really ever encountered anti-Semitism to speak of. So that's not what you'd expect, but it was my truth.
Tim, we're running low on time, but you know, you would think that I would use this time to play a clip from one of your many brilliant acting performances in acclaimed films, or one of your own brilliant acclaimed films. But instead, I'm going to play a clip from Scooby-Doo 2. My guest, Tim Blake Nelson, played the villain of Dr. Jonathan Jacobo in Scooby-Doo 2, Monsters Unleashed. Jacobo is a former scientist and master of disguise who committed bank robberies for his experiments to create real monsters. In this scene from the end of the film, he's been apprehended. The gang unveiled his guises as the evil masked figure and Heather Jasper Howe, played by Alicia Silverstone. Let's take a listen.
As if you getting the lead in My Fair Lady wasn't enough, I was an excellent Eliza. You were too active and stealing my tater tots. You kept saying you felt puffy.
And the real identity of Ned is... Ow. Ned.
I would have gotten away with it if it weren't for those meddling punks and their dumb dog.
That's an actor's dream, to get to say I would have gotten away with it.
I got to say the line. Yeah. It was great. I only ended up playing that part thanks to my my oldest son, Henry. He was 5 at the time. And when the offer came in, I responded on the phone incredulously, Scooby-Doo 2, on my way to saying, I don't know. But before I could say that, he looked up at me and said, he had this very deep voice at the time, you can be in Scooby-Doo, where are you? And I said, okay. And took him to this, you know, he was on the set and had a great time, and so did I.
Tim Blake Nelson, I'm so grateful to you for coming on Boulevard. It was really great to get to talk to you.
It has been my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Tim Blake Nelson. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is available to stream now on Netflix. It is an absolute delight. I don't know what I can tell you to recommend it, but I can tell you that if you've already seen it, you will appreciate that I'm about to say. Pan shot. It's like a inside reference for future you. Anyway, Tim is also a playwright. His latest work is called Socrates. It's going to be playing at Martinson Hall in New York starting this April. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Mary Randolph Carter, known as Carter to friends, has worked high up at Ralph Lauren for decades. She's a creative director there. That's her day job. And in her free time, she collects stuff. She calls it junk, and she has a lot of junk. In her apartment in New York, where she and her family have lived for decades, her walls are filled with old pictures, portraits, photos, that kind of thing. She stacks books under desks, along walls, sometimes out in the open. If you're sitting on her sofa with a drink, your best bet is probably to hold on to it. More often than not, her coffee table, which I'm sure is an antique, is covered in vases and sculptures and more books. Always more books. Does her place look busy? Well, yes, absolutely, it does. But it doesn't look cluttered. It's deliberate. It's thoughtful. It's welcoming. Everything in the apartment has a story. Maybe the goofy-looking bird knick-knack on the shelf over there is something she picked up on a road trip 10 years ago. Maybe the portrait in the living room reminds her of a relative she lost years ago, even though she picked it up at a swap meet in Queens. It's all junk, like she says, but that doesn't mean that it's worthless. It's what makes her home her home. She's written quite a number of books now about junk. Photos of flea markets, guides to antique stores, design inspiration. And she has a philosophy of design so articulate and simple, she summarizes it in her book titles. Like, a perfectly kept house is the sign of a misspent life. Or, never stop to think, do I have a place for this? Her latest book is The Joy of Junk. Go right ahead. Fall in love with the wackiest things. Find the worth in the worthless. Rescue and recycle the curious objects that give life and happiness. And as a person who myself once flew literally across the entire country to go to a flea market, I couldn't be more thrilled to talk with her. Carter, welcome to Bullseye. Great to have you on the show.
Well, thank you, Jesse. I'm really very happy to be here.
You grew up in Richmond, Virginia. Did you grow up in a house full of stuff?
I have to think about that. It was certainly a house full of children and people, and I guess we had a lot of stuff, too. Yes, I would say we had a lot of stuff, but not as much as we had later when we left Richmond.
How did you think about your home? Like, was it totally transparent to you, or did you think of it as a special place?
Oh, totally a special place. It was, you know, it's funny because I've lived in New York longer than I lived in Richmond or in Virginia. And still, when we go to Virginia, which is where I always say we're going home. And my husband says, no, but that's not your home. But someplace in my heart and bones, it's still home. So, yes, it was a very special place because of the people and the stuff and the dogs and the cats and the parakeet Ernie that I had. But I left Richmond when I was probably around 12 years old. So, and moved down to the northern neck of Virginia, the Tidewater area on the Chesapeake Bay and the Rappahannock River. And I think, so my homes are kind of split. But Richmond was where I was born and where I, you know, lived until I was 12 and maybe furnishing that little dollhouse that I had up on the third floor was where that junker streak began when I was looking for those odd things to make it special for my dolls. We left that home rather unexpectedly because we had a very tragic fire one night and lost three of my family. So eventually we actually, I wouldn't say fled, but the memories from my mother, particularly, she lost her father and her great aunt and her aunt and her sister, were too much to bear. And so we moved to the Tidewater area where we had lived in a funny old barn in the summertime. And we started our lives over down there and created a new home for ourselves.
Did having that experience of that tragic fire change your relationship with home and with stuff?
Certainly with stuff. I think you learned that even though someone kindly found one of my dolls, or actually I think a teddy bear that was saved. Yes, of course, we lost the things that were important to us, and all the other things didn't matter. And then I guess I have to share with, I don't know why I'm taking you through the tragedies of my young life, but then when we moved to Whitestone into River Barn was the name of our house, when I was 16, which would have been about 3.5 or 4 years later, we had another fire. And at this time, we were all saved. meaning my mother and father and my two brothers and sisters. There were nine of us. We lost our dog, who went back in to find my father. But the next day when I walked over, it was a big sand pile of ashes. So we really lost everything. But we didn't, because that night when we stood there counting each other over and over again to see if we were all there. There was one sister missing, and then we realized that she had gone to an overnight party. We were all saved, and all the stuff, the books, the paintings, the photographs, everything was gone.
You know, I've seen pictures of your apartment in New York and your home in New York State.
Yes.
And, you know, in your apartment, there's hardly an inch of wall that isn't covered with a painting or something else. And I wonder if that was always the way that your home looked. I mean, like, once you had your own house, was it always chock-a-block?
Well, it took time, you know. I'm very old, and I've been collecting for many years. So, when I moved to New York and had my first, you know, five-floor walk-up studio apartment, I brought with me things from Virginia, from my home, like a blue-painted rocking chair, a few old quilts, a sampler to put on the wall, things that were kind of totems, I suppose, of that life that I loved, but couldn't wait to get away from. I was destined to come to the city for a long time, but I still wanted to create the environment. Obviously, you know this by looking at those pictures, the environment that I place myself in and that I've created for me and for my family eventually. Everything is, it's very, very, very important to me. So to start off in that apartment, I needed things that I could relate to and made me feel comfortable and were a thread to the life. And so slowly, yes, I mean, it was easy to cover the walls in a studio apartment, but I think that yeah, every place that we've lived, and we've lived in the apartment, which is not, it's kind of strange for urban dwellers, but we've lived in the same apartment for like four decades.
I mean, I think the real question that all of us who want to acquire furniture and things to put on the walls face is, where do you put a television?
That
like,
is
there something you can put in front of the television?
That is something, yes, that we've all had to deal with. And particularly when the TV sets started getting bigger and bigger, you know, these widescreen, whatever you call them.
You're a flat screen, sure.
Flat screen. Okay, the big flat screen. Well, this is the most wonderful serendipitous moment. I'd gone into this, let's say this is 2 years ago, and they were shopping, my husband was shopping for this big flat screen to put in the country house. And I was like, oh, no, you can't disassemble my beautiful little front parlor. But anyway, and so I happened at the same moment that he was doing that, I was hunting down a cupboard. Well, I wasn't hunting for it, but it stood in front of me, this big, beautiful blue cupboard. And I bought it, not thinking about where it would go or what would go in it. But guess what fit perfectly in it? The flat screen TV. And then I surrounded it with all kinds of objets and books. There have been times when I have, you know, actually put like an old quilt on top of the flat screen. But no, I'm living with it now. But that was just so incredible. My desire for this cupboard and my husband's desire for the flat screen, they met and married and are living happily ever after in the front parlor of our room that used to be called the purposeless room. because it really didn't have a purpose. I mean, my husband would say, what is this room? It's not a TV room. It's not a dining room. I said, well, originally it was the front parlor. And then we put his mother's baby grand. We stuffed that in the corner. And then I said, well, we can call it the music room. But eventually, now it's the TV room.
How did you end up becoming a junker? Because I don't imagine that there's a huge volume of junkers in the New York City magazine business where you cut your teeth for a couple of decades. New York is a hard place to be a junker because you kind of got to go somewhere to get the space to have a flea market.
Well, that's true. But you forget about junking on the city streets. I mean, it is a gold mine out there. I mean, I find things all the time. So it's not just and New Yorkers, that dealers are very clever. They take weekend parking lots that are abandoned for the weekend and they turn them into flea markets. But I will tell you, it's harder and harder to find those places. But junk is alive and well in New York City for sure. I have evidence of it in this book.
We'll finish up with Mary Randolph Carter in a bit. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk about her other big occupation, creative director at Ralph Lauren, one of the biggest clothing companies in the world. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message come from Buffett, the comforter made better for you and the earth. Buffett uses natural eucalyptus to create a soothing, silk-soft fabric and rejuvenates recycled bottles into a cloud-like fill, all to create a comforter with 4.8 stars across 13,000 reviews without cruelty or waste. Visit buffy.co to experience the complimentary 30-night trial and use code NPR to save $20 on your purchase.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, and this week on the TED Radio Hour, we're exploring ways to seek out joy in some places you might expect and in some places you might not. Where joy hides, check it out this week on the TED Radio Hour, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Kira. So Max FunCon tickets go on sale this Friday, November 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific, and I'm trying to write a promo.
Okay, so what do they need to know to look forward to? Inspiring classes.
Live podcast tapings.
A stand-up showcase.
The s'mores party.
Making new friends.
Don't forget about the dance party!
Oh, and it all takes place on a beautiful mountaintop.
Okay, got it. Anything else?
Well, if we missed anything, they can find all the details at maxfuncon.com.
And we'll see you in June!
I think that went really well.
That was really good, too.
That sounded good.
Great job!
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest, Mary Randolph Carter, is maybe one of the most interesting people I've ever talked with on the show. She's a creative director at Ralph Lauren. She's an expert in the world of collecting. She's the author of a bunch of beautiful books about that latter topic. Her latest, The Joy of Junk, is out now. Do you have a favorite junk store? One of your old books had a directory of junk stores by location.
By state or, yeah.
Yeah, and I was looking through it, and I saw this shop called Crim's Crams.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. In San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. It was right near where I grew up.
Oh.
And this book came out, I guess, maybe 1990 or something like that. So I bet that was probably around when it ended up closing. But I had the most immediate, vivid flashes of memory of being, you know, an 8-year-old and going there and buying a lunchbox.
Really?
And borrowing 20 cents. It cost 20 cents. They told me it cost 20 cents. So I went home to my house, to my apartment and my mom's apartment, and got my mom to give me two dimes so that I could. This is like a story from 1952, but it was like 1989, to get this Super Friends lunchbox at Crim's Crams. Yeah, I grew up two blocks from that store. I thought, like, what an incredible, like, vivid part of my life that store was. And I wonder if there were stores like that for you.
Well, certainly. And, I mean, I remember Crim's Cram or whatever it was called. What a great name. I mean, I was doing Big City Junk. No, I wasn't. I was doing Kitchen Junk, which was my third book in the my version of the Alexandrian Quartet. There was American Junk, and then there was Garden Junk, and then there was Kitchen Junk and Big City Junk, which was published
a week after 9/11. How ironic was that? But anyway, I was going from city to city and looking for great, you know, junk. And Krim Krams, I remember, had great kitchen artifacts. It was a great store. But do I have – I have favorites. You know, part of it – part of this whole journey, part of it's nostalgic. And so when I think about some of my favorite stores or junking journeys or jaunts, it was – with my mother, who really was, you know, the book is dedicated to my mother, who was Mary Randolph as well, but they called her Pat. But we would go to the Outer Banks of North Carolina in the summer. It was really became an escape for my parents because we always used to come down to Virginia in the summertime and stay with them, but they never got away, you know. So they eventually bought this little cottage in the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and we would go down there at the end of every summer. I don't know why. We went at the end of the summer, I guess because we felt that was a good way to end the summer, to be all together. But it was also hurricane season, so we always were being left, you know, we always had to leave, you know, when there was a threat of a hurricane. But in any case, when we were there, we spent a lot of time junking together. And there was a little shop called Merry-Go-Round Thrift Shop. The Merry-Go-Round Thrift Shop. I can see it right now. It was just a, it was a shed. It was a shack. And it was, where was it? I can't remember which town it was in. But that was the first place that we always went. And it was a real bona fide thrift shop, just filled with the discards of the detritus of people's, you know, kitchens and drawers and, you know, closets. But we always, my mother, my gosh, she always found something. She was a great mentor, in my junking life. She was just a great mentor. She had a lot of optimism that she would find something. She had a lot of stamina. Let's go to five more places, and she never left empty-handed. And some people have asked me, well, do you ever leave a place and empty-handed? And I have to say, no. I always find something. It's a bit of a disease. Sometimes I really have to push myself. No, there has to be something here that speaks to me. Maybe there was one or two places.
To me, one of the great joys of buying something old is that it kind of contains two sets of possibilities. One is like an almost abstract, almost purely abstract aesthetic value, right? Something is beautiful in some way.
Yes.
That speaks to you. The second is that it contains this almost infinite narrative potentiality. Because you don't necessarily know what life it had before it was in your hands, but you know that it had some life. And I often feel like if I go into a store and buy a printer, it's dead to me.
No soul.
Yeah, I mean, it's because it hasn't done anything, you know?
It hasn't lived.
Whereas, you know, I think often of what it must have been like before I bought this peacoat at a garage sale in Portland, Oregon when I was 17, you know? Like, it doesn't get cold enough very often in Los Angeles, but I hold on to it in part because of the role it has had in my life, but in part because I know that it has had a life before that. And when your home is full of that, it can feel full of life.
When we first moved into this apartment and it sort of became a scrapbook of our lives and of other people's lives, and people would walk into it with different expectations of a New York City apartment, and they'd walk in and they'd feel enveloped by some kind of country, I'd say, in the beginning. I was probably collecting things that were more country-ish, but they were just kind of enveloped by, I mean, what I was raised being the eldest of nine, living in this old house with this big family, it was always about how your home felt and how people felt in it. That we met people at the door and hug them or whatever. I mean, or just please go in the kitchen and help Carrie peel the potatoes. But there was always this thing about making people feel at home. And I think the things and that your home was personal and comfortable and felt lived in. And I think that when you do find and borrow things that have had that are old and weathered and tattered in some cases and patched, that's evidence of a life lived. And there's a comfort and there's like a mystery. I just feel that, yes, our home is filled with pieces of other people's lives and there's a spirit and a soul. And I think that when people walk in to our home, as they did into my family's home, they felt that intangible kind of connection, a spirit of warmth and love, and hopefully some hospitality was provided.
You've worked for the past 25 years or so at Ralph Lauren.
Yes.
As a creative director, working first on advertisements and in recent years on a wide variety of kind of various stuff, books and things like that.
Yep.
And I was thinking about Ralph Lauren as a brand and idea. I mean, he's also a man who you know. But I imagine you've spent a lot of time thinking about the idea of the brand as well.
I think that he was a kid that grew up, and you've read it over and over again. You know, he says, a normal kid. I played stickball. I wanted to be Joe DiMaggio or Mickey Mantle. I wanted to be a movie star. I loved to play basketball. He didn't know what a designer was. And maybe he went to camp and he met some different kinds of people. And then one day he walked into Brooks Brothers and he kind of loved what he saw. But, you know, I mean, for Ralph, when he was the youngest of four, and he had two older brothers, and he and his older brother, Jerry, they're incredibly close, and Jerry's worked in the company for many years, they would go out to Army-Navy stores. And Ralph would start to fall in love with things that he would call classic and timeless and that were built for a purpose, like a safari jacket or some kind of a military jacket or a bomber jacket or a pair of chinos. And I think that he loved... I heard a story once that he might have been in France and he saw a waiter that had on this beautiful white jacket and he had to have it. He thought it was so beautiful and timeless. I think that Ralph just created these worlds that he wanted to be part of, but they were all built on authenticity and utility. And I think the reason that he's just celebrated 50 years is because he's always been about things that had a kind of style that would endure because they weren't fashion, they weren't trendy in and out. But I know the first time we met in his office on 40 West 55th, and I walked into his office. I was working at Condé Nast at the time, I'd helped start Self magazine, and I had been at Mademoiselle, and I'd been a guest editor, and I loved what I did, and I loved magazines, and I had no idea of going anyplace else until I walked into his office, and he was, of course, wearing old weather jeans, probably Levi's. And his office was filled with stuff, little toy cars and a beautiful photograph of JFK and drawings that his children had done and Navajo blankets. And, I mean, it was I felt like I was at home, you know, and we talked for hours. And he was so curious about my family and how I grew up. And I think he said, Carter, you live the life that I've kind of been creating. And then he said, eventually I came back to him. I'd written my first book, American Family Style. It was published in 88. And I asked him if he would write the foreword to it. And he said, okay, Carter, I'm joining your family, so I want you to join mine. That was the script.
Well, Carter, Mary Randolph Carter, I'm so grateful that you took the time to come on Bullseye, and I've enjoyed all of your books so much. There's a big stack of them in my house, so thanks for doing this.
I really, really appreciated it. I don't know if we really... Did we talk about junk?
Yeah, we did. I mean, we could list our favorite flea markets or whatever. Mary Randolph Carter. You can call her Carter. All her books are great. I sincerely own all of her books. They are warm, loving testaments to collecting and design. Her newest is called The Joy of Junk, and it's in bookstores now. Every week on Bullseye, we bring you a culture tip from me. It's a segment called The Outshot. So there is a kind of comedy that I call fancy comedy. It's the kind of comedy fancy people admit that they like. It, like, gets written up in The New Yorker and you hear about it on NPR. Sometimes it's about politics. Maybe it's sad instead of funny. Usually when they talk about it, the fancy people, they call it satire, whether or not it actually is satire. Satire is another word for fancy comedy. Now, I will admit, I am talking to you on NPR right this moment. I am a little fancy. I like fancy comedy. But I also like Police Squad.
I'm telling you, you got nothing on me. You're wasting your time.
All right, Eddie, let's go over it again. Where were you last night?
I told you a dozen times I was at the movies.
I've got the sandwiches here.
All right, Eddie, you went to the movies. Now, what did you see?
I told you, I don't remember.
Who had the egg salad?
I don't remember.
Somebody ordered it.
You can't expect us to buy that.
But I already paid for it.
Why don't you give a guy a break?
Thanks a lot.
What's the charge, huh?
$4.58.
What are you trying to do, insult us?
Okay, $3.50. Coffee's on me.
Maybe you saw the Naked Gun movies with Leslie Nielsen. Police Squad was the show that inspired them. It ran for 6 episodes on ABC in the spring of 1982. Or actually, that's not true. ABC ordered 6 episodes, they ran 4, and then they canceled it. Police Squad has a simple setup. It's a parody of a police procedural. At the time, that was like Dragnet, Felony Squad, that sort of thing. In 1982, Hill Street Blues had been on TV for 1 year. NYPD Blue was years away, and that's to say nothing of the really sophisticated cop shows, Homicide or The Shield or The Wire. The police procedural was still all about moving from station to station. A guest star, a crime, an investigation, an interrogation, a solution, wash, rinse, repeat. The creators of Police Squad, Zucker, Abrams, Zucker, the guys who made Airplane, didn't change anything about the genre. They kept all of it. The self-serious tone, the brutal murders, the back projection shots of policemen driving squad cars to crime scenes, cups of coffee and bare bulb interrogation lamps and big metal tanker desks. They just took all that stuff and added 12,000 jokes.
My name is Sergeant Frank Drebin, Detective Lieutenant Police Squad, a special detail of the police department. There had been a recent wave of gorgeous fashion models found naked and unconscious in laundromats on the west side. Unfortunately, I was assigned to investigate holdups at neighborhood credit unions. I was across town doing my laundry when I heard the call on the double killing. It took me 20 minutes to get there. My boss was already on the scene.
In a procedural, everything, every line of dialogue, everything that happens on screen is exposition. In Police Squad, there is all that, but there is also not a single moment without jokes.
The gunman shot the teller, she grabbed the gun and shot the holdup man.
It's the same M.O. as the others.
It could be, but this one has an interesting wrinkle. The gunman twice is a good family man with no prior record.
Can I talk to her?
Sure.
Like, here, they're just crossing to the crime scene. It's a travel moment. But we can see right behind them a body bag being carried out through the open door of the bank. And the body bag and the stretcher are getting longer and longer and longer and longer, never ending, like a magician's scarf coming out of his pocket. And then they cross past that, and inside, there's one of those chalk outlines of the victim on the ground. And then next to it, there is a chalk outline of an Egyptian hieroglyph. And then we see the crime scene photographer shooting a picture of the dead body. Of course, there is a cop smiling ear to ear with his arm around it, posing. And then this nonsense happens.
This is Sally Decker, Frank.
Hello, Miss Decker.
Hello.
I'm Captain Frank Drebin. I understand you've had a pretty rough time.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Cigarette?
Yes, I know.
Well, do you feel up to any questions?
I'll try.
Where were you when all this happened?
I was right here at my desk working.
And when was the first time you noticed something was wrong?
Well, when I first heard the shot, and as I turned, Jim fell.
He's the teller, Frank.
But Jim Fell's a teller?
No, Jim Johnson.
Who's Jim Fell?
Well, he's the auditor, Frank.
He had the flu, so Jim filled in.
Phil who?
Phil did. He's the night watchman, Frank.
If only Phil had been here.
The flood of jokes rolls like a mighty river over and around Leslie Nielsen and his co-conspirators on Police Squad, and it is impossible for a viewer not to be swept up by the current. The boss of ABC at the time said that he canceled the show because, and I swear, this is an actual direct quote, he said he canceled it because the viewer would have to watch it in order to appreciate it. I guess he meant, like, watch it closely. But the same qualities that made it a bad fit to run alongside Three's Company or Happy Days are the ones that make it as funny now as it was then. I mean, how can you resist every episode a visit from the all-knowing Johnny the Stool Pigeon, shining shoes in a shoeshine stand, and giving out the secrets of the underworld?
You know anything about the double killings at the Acme Credit Union?
You're barking up the wrong tree with us, Ralph, twice. He's a good family man and makes a decent living. Wasn't his fault he got fired from the tire company. But who could predict that Brazil would cut off the rubber supply? They're nationalizing the industry in 2 weeks, so he would have gotten his job back anyway.
Particularly when a priest sits down.
What do you know about life after death?
I wouldn't know anything about it. You talk an existential being or anthropomorphic deity?
I mean, maybe ABC was right. Maybe people in 1982 couldn't handle it. Maybe they wanted the familiar rhythms of Taxi or the goofy mix-ups on Three's Company or the heartwarming moments on Heart to Heart. But it's been 35 years since Police Squad aired, and it's only gotten better with age. There's no Simpsons, no 30 Rock, no Veep without Police Squad coming first. It's a testament to the power of unfancy comedy.
You're under arrest. Sergeant, take her away and book her.
Sergeant, take her away. Sergeant, book her.
That's my outshot. That's all for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California. Thanks to building management this week, we went down to the park for a fire drill, and we all got free hamburgers. Nothing wrong with that. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows here at MaximumFun.org are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our interstitial music was provided to us by DJW, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Our thanks to Dan. Our theme song is by The Go Team. Thanks to them and their label Memphis Industries for providing it to us. You should go buy their records because they're great. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, there are hundreds on our website. You can find them at MaximumFun.org. You can also find our recent shows broken down by segment on our YouTube channel, where they're easy to share and watch and re-enjoy. They're also on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, All great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.